Gurudev. So, hi. For those who don't know me, my name is Dimitrios Karasis, and I'm the president of the Ultimate Flying Club, and I happen to be from Greece. And so tonight is a very great joy to have with us in this full moon celebration Dr. Ken Chandler. Dr. Chandler is a former professor at Maharishi University of Management, and he has also been for a lot of years and still is on, in the deep silence of Maharishi's Purusha program. So he has made that great contribution to the world by a group program. Okay, good. Very good. So he has made that great contribution to the world through his long cities program and yogic flying in Purusha, but he has also made another very significant contribution to the world by writing a great book, his book Veda in Greece. This is a book that Maharishi loved very much because it explains how the knowledge of ancient Greece, which is very well known around the world, the knowledge that the philosophers of ancient Greece expounded, and the knowledge that made ancient Greece in ancient times an inspiration for the world, was actually Vedic knowledge, pure knowledge, infinite knowledge of the reality of life, of that absolute eternal reality of life, of unbounded bliss that we have the pleasure to be culturing through Maharishi's programs. And so his book shows very clearly how through the enlivenment of Maharishi's pure knowledge, which was the knowledge of ancient Greece, Greece and the whole world can rise to the level of living that pure knowledge, which means living life in fulfillment, infinite fulfillment and infinite bliss, a life of heaven on earth. So it's a very significant contribution to the world, and all of us in the Greek Transcendental Meditation Movement are very eagerly looking forward to the publication of his book, because it has the potential to really transform Greece. In Greece, everyone admires and respects very much the ancient Greek philosophers, and when people see what was the essence of the message of the ancient Greek philosophers, which was to transcend and experience infinite awareness, when people see that, there is great potential that the whole country can be transformed in the direction of ideal quality of life. And also it's a great discovery. It has great significance for the whole world. We know that in the whole world, people admire very much the ancient Greek philosophers. So with when this discovery comes to the surface, it can bring waves of transformation and waves of bliss through Maharishi's programs everywhere in the world. So let's welcome Dr. Ken Chandler. Take it away.
Dimitri is going to bring enlightenment to Greece. He's going to help bring the whole knowledge of the transcendent that will enliven and create a new awakening in Greece and bring about a new golden age. So we're very happy to have him here at MIU. I just finished today 5 days of Panchakarma at the Raj, and As I was finishing up my nasi this afternoon, the text said, now no focus for the next 12 hours. So I thought to myself, okay, this is going to be interesting. Interesting evening. But I think a little bit of focus is okay. I began about 30 years ago to ask a question that most people never ask about the great classics of Western and Eastern literature, philosophy, science, religion, and the arts. And even the great generals and statesmen and inventors and people of all walks of life. And I ask if any of these great men who we all regard as famous and eminent and respected men of Western and Eastern thought, I ask if any of them have described clearly the experience of pure consciousness. And that research question became a seed that began to blossom and to flower over the years. And much to my surprise, I found that the experience of pure consciousness is described by many of the greatest men and women of the East and the West. And pure consciousness, the three-in-one structure of pure consciousness, the sequential emergence of the many from the one, the infinity collapsing to its point, cosmic consciousness, God consciousness, unity consciousness, the whole mapping of higher states of consciousness that Maharishi has brought out has cast a totally new light on the entire history of civilization, East and West. And instead of seeing Eastern and Western civilization as two contrary and opposite and irreconcilable divisions in the human sphere, what I have been finding is that East and West are completely meaningless distinctions, because the great minds of the West as well as the East have clearly described the same states of consciousness. I first became aware of this probably reading Aristotle, when I found that when you properly translate his basic themes in Book 12 of the Metaphysics, that he was not just describing a theoretical, hypothetical, conjectural God. When he talks about God, he uses exactly the terms that we understand to describe pure consciousness. It's one, it's simple, it's eternal, it's unbounded, it's a state of rest, it's a state of bliss, it's a state in which knower and known are identical, it's a state in which consciousness is conscious of itself. For centuries, this has not been known because of mistranslations. The key words that Aristotle uses have been translated as thought, thinking about thinking. The Western scholars, who are very good scholars, but they don't know about the deeper level of the mind, the level of the mind that's beyond thinking, beyond activity, in the silence of pure consciousness. And because they don't know about it, when they come across a word, a Greek word like a nous, N-O-U-S, they translate it as thought. And noesis, they translate it as thinking. So that God, who Aristotle clearly says is simple and unchanging for eternity, gets translated as thought, thinking about thinking. It's a complete mess. And that's the way scholarship stands pretty much today, in complete absence of any real understanding of what Aristotle was, or Plato, or any of the Greeks, or the Vedic tradition was about. And so with our knowledge, with Maharishi's knowledge, and the map that he's given us of the whole territory of higher states of consciousness, we can come, all of us, have a better position, we're in a better position to understand the great classics than even the most erudite and respected scholars of the West, because they simply lack that clear paradigm and they lack the experience. And so there's just not a basis for real deep understanding of Aristotle or Plato or anybody else. So as I begin to read Aristotle, I found these very precise descriptions of pure consciousness, but there was also a question, does he actually talk about experience? Does he say he has experienced it? Well, I came across a remarkable passage, in fact, three or four passages, in which he says, this is a state we enjoy in our best moments. And God is permanently in this state. And if God is permanently in this state, it's a state we can be in. Well, I'll read you the quote in a minute and get it exact. But he says basically that we can be in the state that God is in eternally in our best moments. And then I found Spinoza talking about the same eternal, one, infinite, unbounded being and saying that we know by experience that we are eternal. We know by experience that we are eternal. What kind of experience? Well, most people have no clue what kind of experience he's talking about. And we know, we all have that perspective, that there's the experience that comes through impressions of the senses, and then there's a very different kind of experience that comes when we close our eyes and we settle the mind and there are no impressions of the senses or thinking present. And the mind simply is awake in itself and knows itself in a state of pure consciousness. So after I saw Aristotle and Spinoza were very clearly identifying the main properties of pure consciousness, I said, now this is way beyond the pale of what Western philosophers think. Most philosophers are convinced that all the philosophers were doing rational thinking and they were thinking about things and creating speculative systems and worldviews and they were giving their opinions. That's the way philosophy is regarded in the universities today, and pretty much 99.99%. But the truth about history of Western philosophy is that I won't say all because that would frighten you away, but many, many of the great minds of the West, as well as the East, describe pure consciousness precisely in the terms that Marsh uses, and they say or imply they had the experience. Now, in order to check myself and do a reality check, I thought I better set out criteria for what counts as a description of pure consciousness. So I made up a list of the properties of pure consciousness that Maharishi has identified over the years. And, in fact, this is only a partial list. There's a much larger list of 108 properties. These are descriptive terms and phrases that Maharishi has used over countless years to describe pure consciousness. And you all recognize them. They're very familiar. You don't need to repeat them, really. It's one, simple, unchanging. It's silent. It's a state of rest. It's unmanifest. It's quiet, settled, still, same over time. It's evenness, undifferentiated, and so on. And then starting at the top of the second column, we get the properties that identify it as something not just in the mind, but something that's eternally at the foundation of things. It's eternal, unbounded, unlimited, all-pervading, infinite, vast, indivisible, continuous, unconditioned, primordial, cosmic, universal, invincible, indestructible, immortal, uncreated, and so on. And then the third column, those are the qualities of it as a state of consciousness that identify it as the I, the self, or consciousness, three equivalent terms. It's called pure wakefulness or pure subjectivity. It's eternally conscious of itself, and the knower is knowing itself, and it's pure self-referral or self-knowing. It's the identity of the knower and the known. Empty of content, awareness without an object, perfect clarity, and so on. And the fourth column is what we call the value terms or axiological terms. It's bliss, unconditioned joy, highest happiness, eternal peace, unlimited creativity, infinite organizing power, and so on. You probably all know these as well or better than I do. So I set this out as a list of criteria that could be used to identify descriptions of pure consciousness. So I had two criteria. Do they use a subset of that list to describe pure consciousness? And do they say explicitly or imply they had the experience? So what I found over the last 30 years of research, and it was a mind-blowing journey of a voyage of discovery that it just really is so outside the realm of Western understanding of things, that I found over time about 325 of the most famous people in the East and West have described this to some in some degree of clarity and purity. Aristotle is one of the clearest. As I said before, Jesus probably gives the longest list of properties characterizing pure consciousness in works that he gave, in teachings he gave to his disciples and that were written down, but that have since been lost and found again and denied by the mainstream people who don't really follow his teaching at all in a very full way. Plato, Aristotle, Spinoza, Kant, Hegel, Whitehead, I could go on and on for 325 more. The point is that Maharishi is not to be understood as an Eastern thinker, as an Eastern representative, but as someone who has uncovered for us the deeper meaning of our own intellectual, philosophical heritage and made it available in a very simple and easy form throughout the world. So that's one thing I take away from this, that Maharishi has been radically misunderstood as someone representing an Eastern point of view. It may be true that the Eastern texts, the Upanishads, the Brahma Sutras, the Yoga Sutras, describe more Brahman and unity than the West, but there are people in the West that describe Brahman and unity. And the Yoga Sutras surely are about transcending and pure consciousness and cosmic consciousness. So there's no real distinction. It's just that if you know the seven states and you look at the different thinkers from all different traditions, what you see is that they can all be fit very easily into, oh, this man was talking about pure consciousness, or this man was talking about cosmic or God or unity consciousness, or this man was describing the sequential emergence of the many from the one, or the three-in-one structure and how the three-in-one structure interacts with itself. And all those things that Maharishi has brought out so brilliantly and clearly for us can be found very, very clearly said in the great works of the West as well as the East. So this idea that East is East and West is West, and then never till the two shall meet, that's just mythology. It's not true. East and West really do meet on the ground of a proper understanding, a full understanding of the seven states of consciousness. Maharishi's analysis of consciousness is universal. It describes the experience of people in all cultures. It describes the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Mesopotamians' experience, who all describe pure consciousness, and they all say or imply they had the experience. It describes the earliest Greeks, the pre-Socratics, the later Roman philosophers, the Christians, the Islamic Sufis, the Judaic tradition. The Renaissance was a resurgence of interest in this very topic of transcending and the experience of pure consciousness. And the 17th century science grew out of it. And the great inventors like Tesla and Ford and Edison and Lindbergh, and it goes on and on. There's just wherever you find a great man or woman in history, you find it's very, very likely that they describe that became my guide, is that the greater the person, the more likely they had described pure consciousness or some of the higher states of consciousness. And so one way to look at this is an analysis of greatness. Where does greatness come from? Where does greatness spring from? It comes from that refinement of the nervous system, that refinement of consciousness that comes through transcending and that brings out the experience of the eternal, infinite, unbounded wholeness of things. It's gained through a very simple practice, and I'll call it the practice of transcending to make it general enough, because Descartes and Plato and dozens of people have talked about a technique, and they've described it in such a way that, yes, you would recognize it as a technique that probably was very effective at getting the experience. Not as precisely the same as our transcendental meditation technique, but very, very clearly recognizable as a technique. And I'll give you a little bit of Plato's in a moment. So this was the list, the criteria that I used, plus the criterion, do they say they had experienced it? And using that criteria, I think I was able to achieve a very reasonable demonstration that this knowledge of that Marcius brought out, the Vedic knowledge, is found in somewhat fragmented form, or not quite so pure form, in some cases very pure form, in all of the major traditions and cultures of East and West. So that's what I've been doing over the years. It's been a main focus over a long time, and it's enormous fun doing this. I can't tell you. Every time I pick up a new book and I'm wondering, does this person? He's a very great, well-known poet. Or just most recently, I was reading Edgar Allan Poe, and I thought, well, now he's surely not everybody does it. Not everybody has had the experience. And then I just found it so beautifully expressed. I mean, just so clearly expressed. And again and again and again, that's been my experience. That there's only been one or two people that I thought I should find, and I couldn't find an expression of experience or pure consciousness. And out of several hundred. So that's the background. Now I want to talk a little bit about the Vedic tradition and the Greeks. And I will say, I don't know, hopefully you don't look on the internet to find out when the Vedic tradition was, because you get these really weird dates of, like, the Rig Veda was written in 1800 or 1600, and the Gita was written in BC, and the Gita was written in 500 AD, and it's very crazy. I recently found a man. His name is Dr. Achar. He's a physicist at a university in the U.S. who has used computer software, stargazing software, astronomy software, to identify the descriptions of the night sky that Vyasa gives in the Mahabharata. And there are things that Vyasa says. He says at one point that Mars was at Aldebaran, and this planet was here, and this planet was there, and lots of different, very precise descriptions of the night sky. So Achar took those descriptions, and he searched the night sky back 5,000 years to find when Mars was at Aldebaran, and he found like 78 instances, and then he searched those to find when there were two full eclipses within 2 weeks, which can happen under very unusual circumstances, and he narrowed it down until he found a date. The date he found was 3067 BCE, 5,000 years ago, and that's precisely the date Maharshi gives to the Mahabharata in, I think, the introduction to the Gita or the Science of Being, and the idea is that the Mahabharata is 5,000 years ago. That puts the whole Vedic tradition far, far earlier than that. Now, most scholars today can't fathom that, and most archaeologists, Indologists, and most people just find it unbelievable because it's so far outside the range of what we've been thinking. But this is the first hard evidence that I've seen that really helps to date the Vedic tradition. And there were scholars in the 19th century who also used that kind of astro-archaeological data to date the Brahmanas, and they put them in the 4th millennium BCE. So there is a lot of evidence. I think it's good evidence that puts the Vedic tradition very ancient. So that what happened is that the Vedic tradition was a kind of wellspring, a source, and that the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians and the Israelis and the Greeks and the Romans all were like branches of the Vedic tree. The root is the Rig Veda. The trunk is all the branches, all the 40 branches of Vedic literature. And then the Vedic tradition branched out sometime after the Gita and the Mahabharata in the early, around 3000 BC. And you find then expressions of it in Egypt and Mesopotamia. Very, very clear expressions of it, of this knowledge. I don't think that they were copying the Vedic tradition. I don't suggest that they were just using the same terms. I think they had a technique and that they were having experience and they gave it their own form of expression. One of the most exciting parts of my discovery, my voyage of discovery, was to find the ancient Egyptians. The Papyrus of Ani is a very ancient text that was, I think, from the 17th dynasty, somewhere around 1500 BC. And I was reading it, and I kept finding these beautiful expressions of the infinite, eternal light of God, and I thought, wow, this sounds very like, it could be a description of pure consciousness. Infinite, eternal, unbounded, but I couldn't find any reference to experience. And then one day I was reading and I found, there it was. I have collected myself like a beautiful golden hawk. You can just picture a hawk coming in for a landing and collecting itself on a tree. I have collected myself. I have settled myself. There it was. I have settled myself. That's how you know that they were not talking theory, they were talking experience, because it came from settling the mind. And that's, of course, how the Vedic tradition describes the Yoga Sutras, the classic description of transcending, describes transcending as settling of the activity of the mind. And we would add, while the mind remains awake, the settling of the activity of the mind. So it is in the Greek tradition. And the Greeks, we don't know how exactly it came into Greece, but we do know that there were people who came to Athens at the time of Socrates and who met with Socrates, people from India. There are five different ancient accounts of people who had come in, who had come to India from, come to Greece from India, and the clear. What I want to say is that there's not exactly a clear route that we can trace a technique coming into Greece, but we certainly can see that Greece had very precise descriptions of pure consciousness permeating the earliest pre-Socratic tradition through Proclus in 585 AD. Good. A little higher? Okay. Yes. Is that too close? So I'll get it right in a minute. Hopefully quickly. Okay. So let's just jump into to Greece. I think I've given you some sense. Excuse me. It's too loud. Some sense that the Greeks I'll do my best. The Greek philosophical tradition called the pre-Socratics began 585 BC is the date that's commonly given, because Thales, who was the first, predicted an eclipse in that year, and that's how we know that's how we date it. 585 begins the Greek tradition. And this, you have to realize, is 2,500 years after that date of 3,000 BCE that was the Mahabharata, the end of the classical golden age and the beginning of the of Kali Yuga in the Vedic tradition. So the Vedic tradition was very, it's as ancient to the Greeks as the Greeks are ancient to us. 2,500 years ago for the Greeks and for, the Veda was 2,500 years ago for the Greeks. And so let's look now at what actually, well, first I just want to say my one of my lead-ins into the Greeks is to ask the question, how can we explain this brilliant creativity that we find in Greece? Greece is regarded as the birthplace of Western civilization. The Veda is the birthplace of Eastern, or civilization, if you will. But Greece was the birthplace of Western civilization. I think everybody in the West agrees to that. It's just sublime beauty poured out of Greece in the form of its sculpture, its temple architecture, its face painting, its drama, its philosophy. Even democracy and the Olympic Games came out of Greece. I think you all know this, so it's not a big deal. But what's interesting is that Greece, this magnificent creativity that most many scholars have called the glory of Greece, hasn't been explained. How did it happen? What caused it? And so my question is, what can explain this glory of Greece? And we might also ask, what could explain this glorious outburst of creativity in the Vedic tradition, the Upanishads, the Yoga Sutras, the Brahma Sutras, all the 40 branches of literature? That creativity was an explosion of creativity in the ancient world. It was just like, it came. Most scholars think it just came out of nowhere. It came out, as we will see, of the experience of transcending. Now, I just want to mention about the bronze statue there from Delphi from the 5th century is called the charioteer of Apollo. Now, you've heard the expression, Brahman drives the chariot? Well, here's Apollo, the god of light, the light of God. And according to ancient legend, Apollo drives the chariot across the heavens every day. Apollo drives the chariot. Interesting. It's almost a Vedic expression, isn't it? Apollo represents, among other things, light and wholeness and the source, the organizing power behind all activity. Is that clear? Do I need to say more? Got the idea? Okay. Athena, the goddess of wisdom. The Greeks built this magnificent temple on the Acropolis, the Parthenon, to honor Athena, goddess of wisdom, the virgin goddess of wisdom. And Athena, as Plato describes wisdom, can be understood as life established in the eternal, in eternal self-knowledge, immortality and wholeness, health, wholeness, immortality. That's how Plato describes wisdom in the dialogue called the Charmides. And I'll say more about that in a minute. Whoops. So that the Greek gods, as the philosophers understood them, were personifications of the qualities of consciousness, of pure consciousness, of unbounded pure consciousness. Plato defines wisdom as this, in the following. When returning into herself, the soul, the self, passes into the other world, the region of purity and eternity and immortality and unchangeability and unchangeableness. And being in communion with the unchanging is unchanging. And this state of the soul is called wisdom. Now, clearly he's talking about a state that is unchangeable, immortal, eternal. Where is such a state experienced? Not through the senses. Never through the senses do we experience anything unchangeable and immortal. Everything that we know through the senses, from galaxies to protons, decay. There's nothing stable in the relative. Nothing stable in the relative. Even quarks and leptons are excited states of an underlying field. They're just vibrations in a field, ephemeral, transitory vibrations in a field. Where do you find something eternal and unchanging? How do you get to it? Only in transcending and going beyond the finest level of thinking, the most subtle level of thought, to that unchanging silence at the basis of all thought. And this is what I find most interesting about this discovery that so many people are describing pure consciousness, is that when you go beyond pure, and when you transcend and go completely beyond thinking and all mental activity, everybody who has had that experience describes it in the same way, using that same set of terms, or a subset of that same master list of terms. When you get down in program very, very deep and get beyond thinking and activity, and all thought ceases and becomes quiet, what remains is simple, unchanging, unbounded, eternal. And that's exactly what Plato was talking about. And all of Plato's dialogues, from the middle dialogues, from the Republic, and from the Symposium, Charmides, Republic, Phaedo, Phaedrus, on, describe that eternal, unchanging state of being. I said that Plato described transcending also. Plato uses the language, by the way, of direct experience. He often talks, I've collected about 6 or 8 places where he talks about the state of eternal being as something we behold or we experience or we know it when the mind is in a state of rest. But Plato also goes on to, I mean, especially in the Charmides, this dialogue that so few people read or even know about, he describes transcending, and he uses exactly the Vedic terms to describe it. And his main phrases for describing transcending are go within. He talks about the return of the self upon the self. The Vedic expression from the Rig Veda is nivartatvam, return, go back, come home ye cows, come home from the senses to the self. And that refrain goes on and on in the Rig Veda. And it's about, Maharishi has rightly pointed out, I think, it's about transcending. And it's the classic ancient Vedic, it's the classic ancient expression for coming back, return. And Plato uses the same, return to the, he talks about the return of the self upon the self. And you might think this is a bit of a red herring, but Plotinus and Proclus pick up on that return of the self and make it their main theme and talk about transcending in terms of the return of the self. Plato talks about collecting the self into itself alone and gathering the self into itself by itself and remembering who we ultimately are, awakening the knowledge asleep within us, withdrawing from the senses and coming back to the self, freeing the self freeing the self of the leaden weights that attach it to the body. Beautiful expression for stress. And purifying the barnacles that attach the self to the body in stony accretions. Beautiful, huh? You think he knew what he was talking about? He had probably had some unstressing himself. Behold, he uses the language of beholding that which is eternal and unchangeable, gaining wisdom and immortality and wholeness. knowing the self, the seeing that sees itself, the knowing that knows itself. And the Carmides has these amazing passages where he talks about a state of hearing that hears itself, a state of seeing that sees itself. He says it sees itself and it sees things as well, but it also sees itself. And he talks about a knowing that knows itself and knows other things as well. A knowing that knows itself, what could that be? Well, consciousness that's conscious of itself. And he talks at one point about bringing the mind to a state of complete rest and restoring wholeness to body and mind and curing all the ills of the body. And he gives to this young man, Carmides, that he's the name, the dialogue is named for, he gives him a technique and he says, Carmides has been having headaches. And he comes to Socrates and he talks about his headaches. And Plato and Socrates says, I'm going to give you a technique that will cure your headache. I'm going to give you an herb. But before you take the herb, I want to give you something to cure the mind, because you can't cure the body without first curing the mind. So I'm going to give you a technique to cure the mind and bring wholeness and health to the mind. And once you've brought wholeness and health to the mind, then the body will come along and it'll cure itself. So he tells him, he's going to give him a fair word, and he's to repeat it every day until Socrates says he's had enough. A fair word to repeat every day. And it's going to bring wholeness to the body and mind and cure all ills and bring immortality and wisdom, which is understood as that state of life that enjoys infinite, unbounded, eternal, pure consciousness. So do I need to say more about Plato? It's just a taste. I mean, this is a two-minute version of something that I've unpacked in great detail in the book, but you get some idea. Now to Aristotle. Whoops, going backwards. Now, as I said, Aristotle uses this word nous, and nous was the Greek word usually translated as mind. And the word noein, N-O-E-I-N, is usually translated as mind, conscious or thinking itself. There's nous, noein, and noesis. Noesis is thinking, is usually translated as thinking. Nous is thought or mind, and noein is thought. Nous is mind, noein is thought, noesis is thinking. Now, the usual translations of Aristotle, if you read Aristotle, you'll see it was translated by people who never understood, who never got beyond the intellect and the thinking process to know that silence of being. But Aristotle is talking about a state which he says it again and again, it's simple, it's unchanging, it's eternal, and it knows itself, and this knower and the known are identical. Well, that's not thinking. That's not thought. That's not the mental activity that we experience before we transcend. He's talking about the state that we call pure consciousness. And here are some of the expressions properly translated that he uses. And I translate those three terms consistently as consciousness, conscious of, and being conscious. And when you translate them properly, Aristotle says, it is that, speaking of God or this internal self, he says, it is that which is conscious of itself. Its consciousness is a consciousness of consciousness. And he talks about the divine consciousness and its object are not distinct but identical, and the consciousness is one with what it is conscious of. So it's self-knowing consciousness. What is conscious and what it is and what it what is conscious and what it is conscious of are identical. It is pure, conscious of itself, and continuous. Uh-huh. Yes. Yes. Very good. Dimitri just pointed out that when we were reading the 9th and 10th mandalas, that Maharishi said if you change the word mind into consciousness, everything becomes much more clear and understandable. Very, very So many things like that are, you know, there's so many mistranslations. And Aristotle says, perfect consciousness apprehends itself and is conscious of its object in such a way that the consciousness and its object come to be one, and consciousness becomes its own object. Consciousness knowing itself. And he says, if God is in that good state in which we sometimes are, this impels our wonder. And if in a better state, this compels it yet more. So he's in a better state than even we are in when we transcend. And I can only understand that as an expression of unity or an indication of unity. Whoops. He says, when the mind is freed from its present condition, it appears as just what it is and nothing more. And this alone is immortal and eternal. When the mind is set free from its present conditions, meaning activity, it is our only deathless and eternal part without which nothing is conscious. It is the deathless and eternal part of the self, separate from its lower functions. It is never moved, but remains at rest. Now, there is a term that you can take note of. At rest. It's consciousness at rest. Consciousness settled and still. He calls it bliss, and he says it surpasses all other activities in blessedness. He calls it supreme happiness, the most complete form of human happiness. He talks about it as unwearied diligence, untiring activity. And you remember, I'm sure you remember lectures where Marshy talks about activity in cosmic consciousness doesn't tire you out. It gives more energy than it takes. It's a source of untiring activity and unwearied diligence. And when the mind is in that state, he says, it is not affected by impressions. And enjoy such a life as we enjoy in our best moments. So you see a glimpse there that Aristotle and Plato were talking about a state that's eternal and simple and unchanging and conscious of itself and blissful and at rest, settled state of awareness that we enjoy in our best moments. So that's what the Greeks were really about. And these are not minor works. This is Aristotle's most important work. He called it the first science. That was his name for it. But because in the course of history, it got translated as the book after the physics, it came to be called the metaphysics. And metaphysics today has this horrible connotation in the universities as pure speculative thinking and conjecture and intellectual constructs and worldviews. And so that's how Plato and Aristotle are understood in the universities, as giving intellectual theories and constructs. And people think, well, Plato had his worldview and Aristotle had his worldview and everybody had their worldview. And so they were just, you know, they weren't doing anything very important. And so the logical positivist in the early 20th century threw it all out and said, let's do science and forget about all this old stuff. And they threw it out. And it hasn't had a very esteemed place in the universities since, because even though there's still philosophers and people who do philosophy, it's not taken seriously as a source of knowledge. Now, what I want to say next is that this technique of transcending that Plato and Aristotle certainly learned it from Plato, and his father was a physician from Thrace, and that's where it came from. Well, he was not from Thrace. He was from Macedonia, but he, without going into that, the Greeks had a technique which is unmistakably a technique of turning within. That's the way Plato describes it. And where did it come from? I think there's only one real accurate answer. It came from the Vedic tradition. The Upanishads, the Katha Upanishad, well, first of all, the Rig Veda, Nivarta Tvam, return, come back to the self, that was the classic expression. And the Upanishads, the Katha Upanishad, The self is not to be sought through the senses, for the senses look outward to the world beyond, outside, and not within to the self. What the Upanishads, like Plato and Aristotle, were about is a different way of knowing. Not by going out through the senses, but by coming back to the self, closing the eyes, settling the mind, settling the activity of the mind, until the mind is awake in that state of eternal silence. There are levels of the mind very clearly distinguished in the Upanishads. Beyond the senses, deeper than the senses, are the objects of the senses. And beyond the objects of the senses is the mind. And beyond the mind is the intellect. And beyond the intellect is the self in man, the individual ego. Beyond the self in man is the unmanifest self of the universe. So if we just go within and go deeper and deeper and deeper within, we come to that eternal silence of the universal self that Plato and Aristotle and all the others were talking about. Oops. And the Yoga Sutras is the classic expression. You know it well. In this complete settling of all activity of the mind, all is calmed, and what remains is unbounded wakefulness. There was a technique, a method of knowledge. The Vedic tradition was not a way to relax. It was not about relaxation. I mean, sure, you get relaxation, but it was a method of knowledge. And the knowledge that it was about is the knowledge of that inner self that's eternal and unbounded. We can call it God. We can call it the highest self. We can call it cosmic intelligence. We can call it by, it's called by dozens of names. But what enables us to say that they were that these different people in different traditions were talking about the same thing, the same experience, the same state of unbounded eternal oneness, is that they all use the same terms to describe it, that same set of terms. So the same expressions are found in the Vedic tradition. Retire, return to the self from the Rig Veda. Settle the activity of the mind from the Yoga Sutras. Withdraw from the outer. Come back to the self. In the Upanishads, go deep within. Bring the mind to a state of rest and silence. Collect the self within itself. Know the self in solitude. Close the eyes and be still. Unite with the divine. This was the essence of the Vedic tradition, and it spread throughout the ancient world. And I found expressions of it in Australian Aboriginals and New Zealand Maori, and in Eskimos north of the Arctic Circle, and of Mayan Indians and Aztec Indians. In every tradition, every culture practically, the American Indians describe it just as clearly as you'd want to find. In their own simple language, the Mayan Indians talk about the state before the world was created, and it says there were no waves, no waves, no activity, just silence. And the ocean was still. There are many ways of talking about it, many ways of describing it, but they all describe essentially the same state of eternal, unchanging silence. So this gives us, if I stop being dyslexic here, an entirely new perspective on ancient philosophy. Philosophy was not speculative thinking. It wasn't conjecture and worldviews. The ancient Greeks were describing the experience of eternal pure consciousness that's experienced in transcending. So that's a brief glimpse. Plotinus and Proclus went so deeply into the self-interacting dynamics of consciousness as Maharishi has described it. They describe how in knowing itself, consciousness interacts with itself, and the knower and the known interact with themselves to give rise to the diversity of the universe. It's found in the ancient Chaldean oracles and the in the mysteries of ancient Egypt, the so-called Hermetic tradition. It's found everywhere that you find classical writings and classical literature. So what was the secret of ancient Greece? Well, there was a secret, and it's very simple. The Greeks had learned how to transcend, and they practiced it. And I'm going to tell you in just a second what that secret, how that practice got spread to so many people in Greece that you find this magnificent outburst of sculpture and creativity. Here I want to mention this lady here who you probably have never heard of before. The goddess Hezekiah. She was the goddess of silence, stillness, and rest. You've heard of most of the other Greek deities, but probably not Hezekiah. Well, Hezekiah was the goddess of silence, stillness, and rest. The way the techniques of transcending came into Greece, scholars say that the mystery religions came into Greece in the early 6th century BCE, from the east. They don't specify where in the east, but somewhere in the east. And the mysteries of Eleusis, which had been around for hundreds of years, thousands of years maybe. Eleusis is a little town 11 miles south of Athens with a big cave. And the cave inside is a big wide-mouthed cave, and there's a ledge in the cave that's been worn smooth by long people sitting it on a long time. The mysteries of Eleusis were the main way I would propose that the techniques of transcending were passed on in Greece. And there were initiation processions from Athens to Eleusis in September of every year that involved about 25,000 people, or about half the population of Athens. And new people were taken to Eleusis to be initiated into the mystery of Eleusis. About 8 of the most significant Roman emperors had been initiated, including Pericles was initiated, and the 3 great dramatists, Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, all had been initiated. Sophocles was a mystery priest. The mysteries were the way that the technique of transcending, I think, came into existence, and I mean came to be widespread. The practice of transcending came to be widespread in Greece. During the reign of during the governorship of Pericles, the great governor general of Athens, whose name is associated with the glory of the golden age of Greece, the Periclean age, Pericles built the Parthenon and protected Greece through supreme strategy against all sorts of invasions from the Persians. And during his reign, he had a new temple constructed at Eleusis. It was 50 meters by 50 meters. Huge temple, the size of a football field practically. Half of a football field at least, but wider. And I asked myself again and again, what was this huge temple used for? I found one scholar, very well-known scholar and very highly respected, who said that after initiation, the initiates would sit in silence on their sacred sheepskins. Where did they sit? Partly in the caves. Part of this huge temple was built in the side of a large rock mountain so that it was completely silent. It was like being in a cave. The caves at Eleusis were very significant. And Aristotle's school in Macedonia, where he instructed Alexander, was built next to a cave. And King Minos gave his laws to Crete from a meditation cave. And King Zalmoxis of Thrace gave the fair words that Plato learned and Socrates learned from a cave that he had built under his palace. Caves were very significant in the early history of Greece. They were valued for their silence. They were a place to transcend in ease. And we know you can meditate without complete silence, and that noise is no barrier, but the Greeks knew that it helped. It helps to have a good silent cave. And I haven't said much about Socrates. Here's a passage from Plato's Symposium, which describes his And now Socrates, there burst upon the initiate into the mysteries that wondrous vision of the very soul of beauty that he has toiled so long for. It is an everlasting loveliness that neither comes nor goes, subsisting by itself in an eternal oneness. Eternal oneness is exactly what the Greeks, almost all the Greeks, from the earliest pre-Socratics right through Proclus in 585 AD, were talking about, eternal oneness. Now, most people try to imagine what oneness is, and so they form a picture of a ball, a white ball and a black background or something. In the universities, I found that when I was a student and I heard about oneness, I thought, I just tried to picture it as a white ball and a white black background. It's not on the level of sight that the oneness is known. It's by going beyond sight, beyond thinking, beyond intellect, beyond ego, beyond everything, all activity, until you transcend everything. So, I've talked enough, and I could go on and on. I love it, but I want to have some questions. And I think the key to this whole thing, transcend, that's what the Greeks did, and that's how the Golden Age was created, the Periclean Age. Plato says of Pericles, by the way, that he thought Pericles had attained to that state of eternal self-knowledge. He had arrived. He was a realized man. He was known throughout Greece as a great speaker, a great general, everything about him is preserved by history as a pristine reputation. And how did the Greeks rise to such height, this brilliant 5th century BCE, through a practice of transcending? So that's the long and short of it. So thank you. Well, yes, the Christian fathers, the early church fathers, Dimitri was asking if the Old Testament or the New Testament gives any clear descriptions of transcending. And quite definitely, yes. Book two of my four-volume set that keeps growing, as the more I find, the more it grows. Volume two is mostly on Christianity, because the Old Testament, yes. Jesus he gets the gold star for all of them, because he uses more terms from that list that I gave than anybody else, 76 terms that he uses to describe pure consciousness. And you know the story of I wonder if this thing works. I wonder if it works. Probably getting. Can you hear? Can you hear?
Yeah.
Oh, good. If I don't get feedback from that, man. Good. Oh, there it is. No? It's off? Good. Thank you.
The Old Testament. The Old Testament is... Not on?
Well, I'll just have to go back to this. It's not a big deal. Oh, good. Good. Thank you. That was simple. I like to walk around a little bit. Okay. So, you know the story of the Old Testament of Moses leading the people of Israel out of bondage in Egypt? Everybody knows the story of the Red Sea opening and parting. Do you know what Moses says to the people of Israel just as they come to the Red Sea? And the Egyptians are in hot pursuit. He says, "Be still, and God will fight for you. Be still." And the word for still can be translated as silent or be quiet or be still. And throughout the Psalms of the Old Testament, this phrase, "Be still and know that I am God." You know that psalm? Very good. Yes, the Old Testament is full of expressions of silence and stillness. And the main point of that book of Moses about crossing the Red Sea, it's like the Gita, you know, in the Mahabharata. Arjuna is about to fight, and Krishna tells him, "Be established in the self and perform action." Well, he wasn't so much. The context of the battle is a context for reminding, or for presenting, a philosophical principle. And the principle is, go back to the self, be established in the self, be established in being and perform action. The book of Moses is like that. When the people of Israel are desperate and the Egyptians are about to kill them, Moses says, remember the principle, be still, and know that I am God, be still. And there's about 10 different passages in the Psalms in the Old Testament that describe that same state of at one point the Psalms say, meditate upon your bed and know that I am God. Be silent, be still. Those phrases recur again and again and again. So yes, the Old Testament is full of beautiful expressions of transcending. And especially the wisdom tradition of Judaism, and then Kabbalah is just another whole layer. A whole other layer of esoteric wisdom and knowledge of the transcendent. And Christianity is a whole other story. And I'm hoping while I'm here to get my second book on Christianity finished, so on the unity of religion finished, so that I can present that, because that book. It's the most mind-blowing of all, because Jesus himself gave a teaching to his disciples of the unbounded one, the eternal unbounded realm. He gave it to John and to Mary Magdalene and to Thomas and to Judas. And they wrote it down, and those writings still exist today. And because a different philosophy got spread in the name of Christianity, a philosophy of faith and not of experience, most people today deny the existence of these works and say they were Gnostic deceptions. They were not Gnostic deceptions. I can argue that in great detail. They were works that Jesus gave his own disciples. So, Christianity, yes, Christianity and Judaism and Islam and, yes. Interesting question. Candida was asking about the Spartans who are on the Peloponnesian Peninsula, and who were very close to Athens, really, but they don't seem to have gotten this knowledge of transcending. And why? And I don't know. I don't have a clue. Or at least if they did. Well, no, wait. I would have to say, I was in Greece about a year and a half ago, and I went to Epidaurus. There's a magnificent temple there and a theater, And it's where Ayurveda was practiced in Greece. There were, I think, Plato and Empedocles both define health exactly as Charak defines it in the Charak Samhita, as the complete balance of all the four elements. The Greeks only mention four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. Space they don't mention, so they don't have fire like in the Vedic tradition. But the Greek medicine used techniques to balance the four doshas, the four elements, to create health. And that's and so there was, and that was in Peloponnesia. So there probably was knowledge there, but it was in Athens that it really flourished. And Athens became the center and the huge powerhouse in the Greek world. And I would say it probably, well, it all started in the east coast of, in the west coast of Turkey, which is the Ionian coast in the pre-Socratic. So there was, you know, it wasn't just Athens, but it was all over Greece, really. I don't think we can say it was only in Athens. It was just the whole Greek world. But we don't know anything about, there were no Spartans who became famous enough to survive. Yes, Mitra? Oh, uh-huh. One of the seven wise men of Greece was from Sparta. Yes?
Why do you think it just lasted for two generations?
Dr. Travis was asking, why did it last for only two generations, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle? It began with Thales, Anaximander, Anaximenes, Pythagoras, and went through Parmenides, Heraclitus, Empedocles, and Anaxagoras. And Anaxagoras was brought to Athens by Pericles to be his advisor. So you can say Anaxagoras taught it. Socrates was one of his students. Pericles was another. So that it goes back at least to Anaxagoras and probably much earlier. The Ionian coast is where it all began. So it all came into Athens from the west coast of Turkey. So it was Anaxagoras, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and then Aristotle, in his later years, went to Macedonia and tutored the son of King Philip II, who was called Alexander, who became Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great. So that's five right there, and it's about five generations. And when Proclus in 585 AD, the CE. Yes, Proclus traces the people who he had learned the technique from, and he talks about a technique of infinite silence before the transcendent. That's one of his expressions. He talks about a technique that he had learned from his grandfather Nestorius as Asclepia Genia. Uh-huh. Who learned it from her father, who learned it from her grandfather, and he traces it back all the way to Plato. And that's 800 years later, or 700 years later. And so it was a tradition. And it probably began with Thales in 585, which is when the mystery religions came into Athens from the east. So I would say it goes all the way back to the Veda. But we don't have any concrete evidence for that. Yes? Well, two things I'll just mention, and I could mention a lot more, but I started telling you about the huge hall at Eleusis that was 50 meters by 50 meters, size bigger than a half a football field. I kept asking myself, what did they do in that building? What was it for? It wasn't just for initiations one day a year. The Greeks viewed the Eleusinian Mysteries as that which held a high quality of life together for all of Greece. They considered that the success in battle at the Battle of Marathon was due to the Eleusinian Mysteries. So what was going on in the Mysteries? What was going on in this huge hall? One clue that's interesting is that during the initiation rites, I don't know if this is too esoteric, a string was tied around the right wrist of the man in the initiation ceremony. A trivial detail, but if you've been to the yagyas, you know that's still done today in the Vedic yagyas. Were the Eleusinian Mysteries, did they come directly from Greece? Did they have yagyas? I don't know. There's not much evidence for it. But again, this question, what did they do in this huge hall? Why did Pericles spend a huge amount of the Athenian treasury to build a huge hall at Eleusis? Well, group program? I don't know. I mean, that would be speculating far beyond what we know, but certainly it's an interesting idea, especially since the Greeks considered the Mysteries to be the support for everything good that happened in life. And the belief was that if the Mysteries held life together and kept it together, and that if the Mysteries were to be destroyed, they believed that civilization would end. These are the kinds of things that were said about the Mysteries, that civilization would end if the Mysteries were destroyed. Well, in 391, the Christian emperor Theodosius closed the Greek Mysteries and forbade them to be practiced in Greece and tore down a lot of the temples and put up crosses and things. And the books were banned and philosophy was banned and the Olympic Games were closed. The cave at Eleusis was locked. This was in 391. 15 years later, barbarians overran the empire. It was the end of civilization, just as the Greeks believed would happen if the Mysteries were closed. I think they practiced. I mean, I don't believe it in a positive sense, but I think it's a very interesting possibility that there was a group program there. This is too sketchy. The evidence is too sketchy. You know, it was forbidden by law on penalty of death to tell the secret of the Mysteries. And that's why we don't know what it was. Nothing was ever written down about it. Plotinus says you must close the eyes and call upon a vision to be waked within you. That gives you a clue. The word mystery means close, to close. Comes from mysterion, to close. And it meant to close the eyes. And so, to close the eyes? Where have you heard that expression before? Yes, you had a question. Yeah, it's a very good question. Does dialectic have anything to do with transcending? Plato in the Republic also, he talks, dialectic was usually, it's usually construed in the universities today, and most philosophers understand that dialectic was a kind of question and answer that Socrates answered, asked questions and people responded, and he drew out of them a deeper kind of knowledge through his questions. And so it's understood as a kind of thing that happened in conversation. It was a conversational dialogue between several people. And that kind of dialogue is what was considered to be the essential Platonic method. Plato at one point says, the real dialectic is something very different. And if you read the dialogues in the right way, you find that every dialogue takes a concept like justice or beauty and traces it down through Socrates' questions until it gets to the experience of the to the deepest level of the idea, the transcendental level. Supreme. He starts with the beauty of love, loving an individual person, and loving laws and institutions, and loving in a general sense, and then finally, love in the fullest sense, which is the transcendent. So every dialogue takes you from the gross to the subtle. And these dialogues that occurred in conversation were just an outer mirror, an image for a technique that he taught. And he says in his seventh letter, "What finer achievement could there have ever been in my life than to write this down for the masses? But I don't believe it's a good thing to write it down." You don't write the technique down. And it was never written down in the ancient world. It was never written down any time in history until about the 14th century. A book called The Cloud of Unknowing came out of England, which describes a technique. That's the first time it was written down, and that was by a rogue initiator who shouldn't have written it down. Anyway, this whole thing is so fascinating. We could go on and on. Are there any, one last question? Yes, huh? It's in press now. It's I've been telling Bevan for 10 years. It's tomorrow in 2 weeks, and Bevan really wants it to come out because we need to have it. And Craig's book is coming out soon too. Craig Pearson, you know, working on the same kind of thing, and we're doing. It just takes so much time to proof and get all the bugs out of a book. It takes more time than, and I've written these 4 books, and now I've got to go back and edit them all. So it's a huge project. They'll come out hopefully very, very soon. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
Discussion with perhaps other colleagues who know the Greek language very well. Have you had an interchange in terms of the way that
yes, the question is, have I had interactions with people who've translated the Platonic and Greek terms in different ways, and have I run it by them to see if it flies? This term nous, yes, I've had discussions with people, but it's hard, they resist change. For one thing, because academics are—I don't mean to sound negative—but they're somewhat hidebound and somewhat resistant to change. But the argument that I've given them is that Aristotle and Parmenides and so many of the Greeks talk about a state that's simple, unchanging, eternally conscious of itself, and that my argument is that is not thinking. And the proper this isn't about translation, but it helps to translate the terms correctly so that we can have a better understanding. And once you get rid of the reason they can't get beyond the idea that this is intellect or thinking is because they don't have an experience of anything beyond intellect or thinking. And I'm not saying everybody doesn't, but some people might. But generally. The predominant academic view today is still that they don't know what consciousness is if it's not thinking or intellect. And so you have to, first of all, establish what consciousness is, what pure consciousness is. It's beyond all thinking, beyond all intellect. Then you can make some headway with them. Oh, I think it's completely legitimate. Well, I do, but I mean, I can't say that. Here's an expert from Greece right here who can talk to this.
Actually, I wanted to give an example, but the translation is like translating nous as mind. That's what it's meaning today. But like the translations in the Vedic literature, in which Max Miller, a great scholar of Vedic literature, used mind, and then Maharishi says, change that into consciousness, and that you read then and you get another idea. But if you want, I want to spend 2 minutes, if you want, to give you an example of the discussion dialectic, which is words, activity, different from the real dialectic, which is mentioned in the Republic. And Glafkon wrote to Socrates, what about the real dialectic? And Socrates says, I can't tell you what it is. How come you can't tell me if you were talking about this all the time? And then he says, you have to have an experience. Okay? So, do you want to hear an example of what dialectic is and what it needs? Otherwise, I can say 2 minutes it will take. Okay. Okay, sir. Supposedly that Socrates has a student, and he wants to teach the transcendental area of some thought or term so that the individual then will have a great desire to go to that state and have an experience of that. So let's use the word temple. I'll use ordinary language of today so that we understand. So Socrates says, what is temple? And most of the people in the group say, oh, it's a building in which God lives and we go and pray. Okay, very good, says Socrates. But doesn't say in another area that your body is the temple of the living God? So the body also is a temple. And of course, when we think in the mind, ideas, concepts about God, mind now is a temple. And then in one area, Jesus Christ says, in my Father's house, that's a temple, there are many mansions, and I'm going to prepare one for every one of you. Now, what kind of temple is this? That I can go there and go, and you and you. So that area, that temple, has no body, flesh, no mind, thinking, no bricks. Is the transcendental area where God is present. That's the God's house. The word house destroys the idea that it is a transcendental area, but the description that it is immense, that there is a mansion for everyone, that's the one place that we all go when we transcend. I have my house there, you have your house there, and the house is good and big that everyone fits. So we go then these four levels from the environment, bricks and mortar, to the body, the physiology, to the mind, and then to the transcendental level. So when you meet the word temple, how do you translate it? You translate it according to the text. That's what happens in translating higher literature, scriptures, Shakespeare, Plato, or the Vedic literature. You have to have four levels. Another example is soma. Soma is a plant, but soma is a digestive product which the senses absorb to refine the senses. And finally, Maharishi says, soma is the glue of the universe that unites the two opposites of relative and absolute. So when you read the word soma, how do you translate it? When you read the word nous, he says, I'm sorry, Dr. Chandler says, it is not thinking about thinking, thought, It is consciousness. Like Maharishi says, I don't like this word mind in the Rig Veda. Use the word mind, consciousness, and when you do, something comes out. Because consciousness is a higher level of experience than mind that we know. The same thing with nous and many, many words in Plato's, Aristotle's, the Old Testament, the New Testament, in Wordsworth or Shakespeare or anybody who talks. Jai Gurudev.
Thank you, Dr. Kanalakos. That was very, very good, very good. So I thank you very much for coming, and I really enjoyed talking with you. So good to hear that.